Imagine a country with no army, where classrooms replaced barracks and forests rose where others built factories. A place that turned away from war, embraced peace, and became one of the greenest, most democratic nations on earth. This is the untold story of Costa Rica, how a small republic defied military rule, brokered regional peace, protected half a million species, and redefined what it means to lead without violence. From revolution to rainforest, this is not just a history, it's a blueprint for the future. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Costa Rica, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 9, The Cracks Beneath Peace, Labor, Rebellion, Reform. On the surface, the country was quiet. The sun still rose over the central valleys, rolling hills. Coffee carts rolled along dusty roads. Children recited their lessons in clapboard schoolhouses, and banana boats still pulled into Limon, heavy with fruit destined for the mouths of distant strangers. Costa Rica seemed, to the outside world, a republic at peace, stable, democratic, educated. But beneath that calm lay pressure, invisible to many, ignored by most, but real. The kind of pressure that builds not with fury, but with repetition, day after day, harvest after harvest, until one day, the earth beneath the quiet begins to crack. By the early 20th century, Costa Rica was often hailed as an exception in Central America. It had avoided the chronic instability and brutal dictatorships that plagued many of its neighbors. There were elections. There was a functioning constitution. Schools operated, literacy was growing, and civil society was thriving. But the story of peace was never the whole story. It was true that Costa Rica lacked a formal military regime, but it also lacked labor protections, land reform, and equity. For the wealthy, it was a golden age. For the rural poor, the plantation workers, the landless peasants, and the Afro-Caribbean and indigenous communities, it was something else entirely, an age of endurance. This chapter explores the years between 1900 and the 1940s, a time when the facade of harmony began to show its fractures. It is a story of workers and thinkers, of voices rising against injustice, not always in rebellion, but in demand for reform. It is a story not of war, but of awakening. The two Costa Ricas. By the turn of the century, two Costa Ricas existed side by side. One was the official Costa Rica, literate, peaceful, and proud of its democracy. It was centered in the Central Valley, where coffee was king, where public schools dotted every town, and where the children of the elite studied law and philosophy in universities. In this Costa Rica, social mobility was possible. If one had land, education, or the right last name, the other Costa Rica was far less visible. It was a banana zone of the Atlantic lowlands, humid, segregated, and controlled by United Fruit Company. It was the coffee highlands of the South and West, where seasonal workers lived in bunkhouses, surviving on rice, beans, and company scrip. It was the indigenous villages of the Talamanca Mountains and the Afro-Caribbean neighborhoods of Limon, where citizens were denied the right to vote or own land based on race and origin. In the official narrative, Costa Rica was an egalitarian agrarian republic. In reality, it was a republic with deeply entrenched inequalities, most of them hidden behind politeness and the absence of outright violence. But the workers were beginning to speak. The rise of labor consciousness. At the dawn of the 20th century, the idea of workers' rights was still radical. Most Costa Ricans labored 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, with no guarantee of pay, no workplace safety, and no legal recourse. In the coffee fields, laborers worked the harvest for a few months a year, then moved on to seek survival elsewhere. In the banana plantations, Afro-Caribbean and mestizo workers lived in isolated camps, segregated by race, language, and class. Injuries were common. Wages were often delayed or paid in non-cash forms. If a worker protested, he could be fired or blacklisted across the entire region. The state looked the other way. That began to change slowly, first through whispers, then through pamphlets, and eventually through organized protest. The first Costa Rican labor movements were small, scattered, and largely urban. In San Jose, shoemakers, print workers, and public employees began forming mutual aid societies, early precursors to unions. These groups provided support during illness, organized collective demands for higher wages, and even published newsletters questioning the moral legitimacy of unregulated capitalism. Then came the teachers and students, products of the very educational system that Costa Rica took pride in. They began to ask questions that made the elite uncomfortable. Why was it that Costa Rica, so proud of its democracy, allowed racial discrimination to persist in Limon? Why were banana workers paid in tokens and not money? Why did coffee barons pay school taxes, but still keep their own children in private schools? And why was the Constitution silent on the rights of working people? These questions gave rise to reformist voices, and eventually to political movements, the intellectuals and the left. In the 1910s and 1920s, a generation of Costa Rican intellectuals began to turn towards socialism and populism, inspired by both European thinkers and the real conditions around them. Figures like Joaquin Garcia Monge, a writer and educator, began publishing essays criticizing the social hypocrisy of the elites. He wasn't a revolutionary, he was a schoolteacher. But he became an early voice for progressive nationalism, arguing that education should be used not just to create obedient citizens, but to awaken critical thinking. Around him gathered a growing circle of writers, journalists, and lawyers who began to challenge the status quo. Some flirted with Marxism. Others advocated agrarian reform, labor protections, and public health investment. In 1921, strike actions were organized in banana plantations by a coalition of workers, Afro-Caribbean, mestizo, and indigenous, demanding wage increases and better housing. The strike was crushed, but it set a precedent. It proved that workers could unite across racial and ethnic lines, that they had shared interests, even if they did not yet have equal status. These movements frightened the elite, but also forced them to take notice. Some responded with repression, others with compromise. But none could ignore that something had changed: the growing role of government. In the 1930s, Costa Rica, like the rest of the world, was rocked by the Great Depression. Coffee prices collapsed. Banana exports dropped. Unemployment soared. And for the first time in decades, hunger returned to the Central Valley in visible form. The government, still led largely by members of the coffee elite, was forced to act. In 1931, Costa Rica passed its first major labor law, creating limited protections for workers in both public and private sectors. It established the 8-hour workday, banned child labor in some industries, and guaranteed a minimum wage, though enforcement was weak. That same year, a new political force emerged, the Partido Comunista de Costa Rica, PCCR, led by Manuel Mora Valverde, a young lawyer from a humble background who would go on to become one of the most influential reformers in Costa Rican history. The PCCR did not seek violent revolution. Instead, it sought gradual transformation through elections, alliances, and grassroots mobilization. It built support among banana workers, urban laborers, and teachers. It published newspapers. It demanded reforms. And it grew. Meanwhile, United Fruit Company, feeling the pressure of strikes and international scrutiny, began lobbying Costa Rican officials more aggressively. They sought exemptions from labor laws. They insisted on tax breaks. They warned that if conditions became too difficult, they would leave, taking jobs, infrastructure, and investment with them. It was a familiar threat. And Costa Rica, still without a standing army and still dependent on export revenue, walked a fine line between progress and appeasement. The seeds of reform. By the end of the 1930s, it was clear that Costa Rica was changing. Labor unions had formed across sectors. The Communist Party, though still marginal, had won local elections in several towns. Teachers had organized to demand better funding and rural outreach. Journalists exposed the treatment of banana workers in chilling detail. Church leaders began to speak of social justice, framing labor rights as moral obligations. A new generation of Costa Ricans, born after independence, educated in public schools, raised during the Depression, began to imagine a different kind of republic, one where citizenship meant not just voting, but living with dignity. Still, the oligarchy remained powerful, the state remained cautious, and the fear of foreign retaliation hung over every decision. Yet the cracks had formed, not violent fissures, not revolutions, but deep, structural breaks in the illusion of harmony. Costa Rica had not lost its peace, but it had lost its innocence. In the next chapter, we will witness the dramatic culmination of these growing tensions in the form of civil war. A war not for territory or conquest, but for the soul of the nation. We will meet the reformers, rebels, and idealists who led Costa Rica into its most defining moment and emerged with one of the boldest political experiments in Latin American history, a republic without an army. Chapter 10, War in the Garden, the 1948 Civil War. It began with a vote, not a bullet. But before the ink could dry, before the ballots could be counted with trust, the streets filled with men who no longer believed in paper. For a country that had prided itself on peace, 1948 was a rupture. A moment when ideals collided with power, when promises fractured, and when the garden of democracy, so carefully nurtured, erupted into war. Not a war for land, not a war for conquest, but a war for the right to believe the system still meant something. By the time Costa Rica erupted into civil war in March 1948, it had already built a global reputation as a small, peaceful, and unusually democratic nation in a region plagued by dictatorship and revolution. But that reputation, like many masks, was only partially true. Beneath the calm exterior, years of tension had been building. Economic inequality, political polarization, ideological fear, and institutional fragility. The war lasted just 44 days, but it reshaped Costa Rica's future with seismic force. When it ended, one of the most radical political decisions in modern history would be made: the abolition of the military. But before that radical peace, there was war, a fragile republic on the edge. The seeds of conflict were sown in the years leading up to the 1948 election. President Teodoro Picotto, a member of the National Republican Party, had been elected in 1944 with the support of outgoing President Rafael Angel Calderon Guardia, a reformist who had passed some of Costa Rica's most important social legislation. Under Calderon's administration, 1940 to 1944, the government, in alliance with the Communist Party and the Catholic Church, had introduced sweeping reforms. Social security, labor rights, unions, progressive taxation, and universal health care. These policies were unprecedented in Central America and widely popular among the working class. But they also made enemies. The coffee and business elite saw Calderon as a demagogue. The United States, in the throes of the early Cold War, viewed the alliance with communists as suspicious, especially with a rising fear of Soviet influence in Latin America. Political polarization intensified. When elections were scheduled for February 1948, the stakes couldn't have been higher. The opposition, organized under the Partido Unión Nacional, rallied behind a charismatic, aristocratic figure, Otilio Ulate Blanco, a journalist and newspaper publisher who promised to protect democratic institutions while rolling back radical reforms. As ballots were cast, tension gripped the nation. Everyone knew the outcome would be contested. The spark, electoral crisis. On February 8, 1948, the vote took place. Preliminary results showed a clear victory for Ulate over the government-backed candidate, Rafael Angel Calderon Guardia, who was seeking a return to office. But then, a parliamentary committee, dominated by government loyalists, announced that the election was nullified, citing irregularities. They claimed that some ballot boxes had been tampered with, that violence and intimidation had marred the process. Whether or not this was true remains historically ambiguous. What is certain is that the popular will had been disregarded, and with it, the fragile trust in Costa Rica's democracy shattered. On March 12, 1948, a man stepped forward. Not a career politician, not a soldier, but a businessman, coffee grower, and former exile who had returned to his country with a vision in his pocket and a revolver on his hip. Jose Figueres Ferrer, Figueres, and the founding of the Army of Liberation. Don Pepe, as he would come to be known, was unlike any other political figure in Costa Rica's history. Educated in the United States, influenced by socialist ideals and French Enlightenment thought, Figueres was deeply critical of both the political right and left. He had been exiled in 1942 for criticizing the government, but returned to form a movement committed to defending the integrity of the vote, by force, if necessary. After the annulled election, Figueres formed the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the Army of National Liberation. It was a small, ragtag force made up of farmers, students, teachers, veterans, and some foreign volunteers, including anti-Franco Spaniards and leftist Latin Americans. They were poorly armed, but fiercely motivated. What they lacked in numbers, they made up for in moral conviction and tactical skill. Their rallying cry, Por la libertad del voto, for the freedom of the vote. On March 12th, Figueres launched his uprising from San Isidro de El General, a southern town nestled in the Talamanca foothills. His forces moved swiftly, engaging government troops in a series of guerrilla-style engagements across the southern provinces. The fighting spread quickly. Key battles occurred in Cartago, Limon, and Alajuela. Bridges were bombed. Roads were seized. Train lines became lifelines for arms and reinforcements. It was not a large war, fewer than 2,000 combatants on each side, but it was the bloodiest in Costa Rica's modern history, with nearly 2,000 casualties. Government forces, loyal to Calderon and backed quietly by Communist Party militias, fought hard but were poorly coordinated. Figueres' forces, by contrast, were disciplined, mobile, and ideologically unified. And as towns began to fall to the rebels, public opinion shifted. Even those who had supported Calderon began to doubt his grip on power. The war was no longer about Ulate or communists. It had become a fight for legitimacy itself. The turning point and the surrender. By early April 1948, Figueres had gained control of most of the country. On April 19th, after a final offensive in the Central Valley, the government surrendered. President Teodoro Picado fled. Calderon went into exile in Nicaragua. The communist militias dissolved. Ulate, the man whose election had been nullified, was placed under Figueres' protection, but not immediately handed power. Instead, Figueres formed a provisional government junta to rule for 18 months. What he did with that junta would forever change the trajectory of Costa Rica, the rebirth of the republic. Figueres could have declared himself president. He could have created a dictatorship, as so many liberators had done across Latin America. He didn't. Instead, in those 18 months, Figueres abolished the military on December 1, 1948, declaring that Costa Rica would no longer fund an army, but instead invest in education and health. Established a new constitution, 1949, that guaranteed universal suffrage, including for women and Afro-Caribbeans, many of whom had previously been denied citizenship. Nationalized the banking system, ensuring that credit served the public good, not just the elite. Created a robust civil service system to professionalize government and limit corruption. Founded the Tribunal Supremo de Elecciones, an independent body to oversee fair and transparent elections. Then, in November 1949, Figueres stepped down, keeping his promise, and handed power peacefully to Otilio Ulate, the rightful winner of the 1948 election. It was a moment unheard of in Central America. A revolutionary who relinquished power voluntarily, enshrining reforms rather than clinging to them. A war that was also a beginning. The 1948 Civil War was short, but its impact was vast. It proved that Costa Rica's peace was not an illusion, but a choice fought for, earned, and renewed. It marked a clean break from the oligarchic structures of the past. It launched social democracy as the new political consensus, one that would dominate Costa Rican life for decades. And it elevated Figueres to near-mythic status, a revolutionary not of violence, but a vision. But it also left scars. The war fractured families. It introduced violence into a country unaccustomed to it. And it revealed how fragile democracy can be, even in a land that prides itself on peace. Still, Costa Rica emerged stronger. In the next chapter, we'll explore the radical consequences of one of Figueres' boldest decisions, the abolition of the military. We'll trace how Costa Rica became a nation without an army, and how that absence of arms became its greatest defense, not just against war, but against tyranny. Chapter 11. The Army That Never Was, a Bold Experiment. In most nations, power is measured by firepower. A line of tanks, a parade of boots, a flag raised above a field of guns. But Costa Rica chose something different. After a war that could have justified rearmament, it made the most radical decision in its history, to never raise an army again. In doing so, it redefined what it meant to be strong, not through force, but through intention. Not with weapons, but with words, law, and trust. On December 1, 1948, inside the once guarded walls of the Cuartel Bella Vista military barracks in San Jose, Jose Figueres Ferrer stood before the nation. He was not in uniform. He had no bayonet at his hip. And yet, his words carried more force than an army division. He declared, "The army is a thing of the past. From now on, this country will have no barracks. We will never again raise weapons against our own people." Then, with a flourish both theatrical and symbolic, he took a sledgehammer and shattered part of the military fortress wall. The message was clear. Costa Rica would not rebuild what it had just dismantled. The Civil War had ended, and with it, so had the age of militarism. In the wreckage of that wall lay an entire ideology. Why abolish the army? The decision to abolish the armed forces was not spontaneous, though it was daring. Figueres Don Pepe understood that Costa Rica's military had historically been small, underfunded, and used more often to suppress citizens than defend borders. The Civil War had shown how quickly it could be politicized, how easily it could fracture, and how unnecessary it was in a nation with no imperial ambitions. But it was more than pragmatism. It was philosophical. Figueres envisioned a republic that drew strength not from military might, but from social equity, education, and participation. In his eyes, the true security of a nation came from well-fed children, literate citizens, and accessible health care, not generals in command posts. Costa Rica was not under imminent threat from neighbors. It had no foreign enemies, no natural resources to defend with violence. What it did have was a chance to become a new kind of state, a nation that placed its trust in law, not force. To ensure this wasn't just a temporary move, Figueres and the founding junta of the Second Republic embedded the military abolition into Costa Rica's new constitution, ratified in 1949. Article 12 reads, simply but powerfully, "The army as a permanent institution is abolished for the surveillance and preservation of public order. The necessary police forces will exist." It was the first constitution in the world to formally eliminate its military, not as a pacifist dream, but as a governing principle. The global reaction. Internationally, the move was met with a mix of admiration, confusion, and skepticism. In the early days of the Cold War, when the world was dividing into armed camps, Costa Rica's choice seemed almost naive. The Soviet Union and the United States were stockpiling nuclear weapons. Dictatorships in Latin America were tightening their grip through force. Even democracies like Chile and Colombia maintained large armed forces as symbols of sovereignty. Costa Rica, by contrast, looked vulnerable. And yet, the vulnerability became its shield. With no army, Costa Rica presented no threat to its neighbors and little incentive to be invaded. It could not stage coups. It could not back regional warlords. And because it had no generals to placate, no military-industrial complex to fund, it redirected its national budget toward education, health, and infrastructure. And as the decades passed, it became clear Costa Rica had not weakened. It had stabilized. It gained international prestige as a neutral, democratic actor. It hosted peace talks, mediated regional conflicts, and received accolades from the United Nations. In a region soaked in blood, Costa Rica became a sanctuary, a place where ideas could thrive and exiles could find shelter. And most importantly, it worked, redirecting the budget, guns into chalkboards. One of the most immediate impacts of abolishing the military was economic. At the time of the 1948 Civil War, even Costa Rica's modest army accounted for a significant portion of the national budget. With its dissolution, those funds were repurposed. The government invested heavily in public education, healthcare, and social security. Over the next few decades, Costa Rica built a system of universal primary education, expanded its network of public hospitals, and strengthened its civil institutions. Literacy rates climbed. Life expectancy rose. Infant mortality fell. The government also reformed its police force, creating a civilian institution tasked with public order. But bound by strict oversight, professional standards, and clear separation from political power. Unlike in many Latin American countries, where police and military often overlap, Costa Rica's force remained unarmed in appearance, civilian in nature, and community-focused. In essence, the absence of a military forced Costa Rica to invest in its people. A democracy without the gun. One of the most profound outcomes of military abolition was its impact on democratic culture. Without the looming presence of a military, political power had no enforcer. Leaders could not rely on generals to intimidate rivals. Coups became nearly impossible. Election disputes had to be solved through institutions, not tanks. This allowed Costa Rica's democratic institutions to evolve organically, not as facades backed by arms, but as living, functioning systems. The Supreme Electoral Tribunal, TSE, created in the wake of the Civil War, became one of the most respected election oversight bodies in the world. Its independence and transparency gave voters trust in the ballot, a trust that had been shattered in 1948 and slowly rebuilt in the years after. Meanwhile, the judiciary, press, and civil society organizations flourished. With no army to fear, journalists could critique the government without risking their lives. Students could protest without inviting tanks. Civic engagement became not just legal, it became expected. Costa Rica's democracy matured not through the exercise of dominance, but through the rejection of it. Security in a violent region. Of course, peace was not guaranteed. In the 1970s and 1980s, Central America descended into civil wars. Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, armed groups often backed by the U.S. or the Soviet Union, tore their nations apart. Tens of thousands died. Dictators rose and fell. Military juntas crushed dissent. And in the middle of that storm, Costa Rica, unarmed, uninvaded, still standing. Some credited its neutrality. Others pointed to its lack of strategic value. But increasingly, scholars and analysts began to understand. Costa Rica's lack of an army had de-escalated tensions. It couldn't be used as a base. It had no military to threaten guerrillas. It played no favorites. Instead, Costa Rica offered something better, diplomacy. In 1987, President Oscar Arias Sanchez was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his role in negotiating the Esquipulas Peace Agreement, which helped end Central America's brutal civil wars. His efforts were born not just from diplomacy, but from the moral authority of a nation that had no army, the criticisms and the challenges. Of course, the abolition of the army has not been without its critics. Some argue that Costa Rica is vulnerable, that in the face of a large-scale threat, it would be defenseless. Others worry about transnational crime, narco-trafficking, and the growing sophistication of regional gangs, which sometimes outgun local police. To respond, Costa Rica has modernized its police force, increased international cooperation, and invested in intelligence, coastal patrols, and public safety programs. It also maintains treaties with other nations that offer support in times of national emergency. But these challenges have not derailed the vision. Costa Rica remains committed to the idea that a nation can be safe without being armed to the teeth. A moral blueprint for the world. Today, when new Costa Rican students learn their history, they visit Cuartel Bella Vista, not as a military academy, but as the National Museum of Costa Rica. The place where Figueres once shattered a wall with a sledgehammer is now filled with art, fossils, and schoolchildren. It is a daily reminder that strength can look like preservation, not destruction. That peace is not passive. That democracy, when built with care, can defend itself not with guns, but with law, justice, and trust. Costa Rica's decision to abolish the military remains one of the most extraordinary political experiments in the modern world, a defiant belief in the idea that a republic born from war could choose peace and stick to it. And as we look forward, that experiment continues. In the next chapter, we'll follow Costa Rica into the next phase of its journey, where nature itself becomes part of the national identity. A green republic emerges, where forests, biodiversity, and conservation become symbols not only of ecological vision, but of moral leadership. Chapter 12, The Green Republic, From Trees to Tourism. In most nations, forests fall so cities may rise. But Costa Rica, the country that abolished its army, chose a different path once again. Where others saw wilderness to be conquered, Costa Rica saw a cathedral, a sanctuary, a promise. It stood in front of its trees, not with axes, but with laws, not with conquest, but with care. And in doing so, it planted not just seeds, but a vision that the future could be both wild and wise. By the mid-20th century, Costa Rica had already done something revolutionary. It had dismantled its military and invested in peace. But in the decades that followed, it would launch another revolution, quieter, greener, and just as transformative. This was the movement that would turn Costa Rica into a global symbol of environmental sustainability, one that would transform its forests, redefine its economy, and inspire a new kind of national pride. To understand how Costa Rica became the world's green republic, we must go back to a time when it very nearly wasn't. A nation of trees and chainsaws. In the 1950s and 60s, like many developing nations, Costa Rica faced intense pressure to modernize. Agricultural expansion, road building, and foreign investment were seen as necessities for growth. And that meant clearing forests. Cattle ranching became a dominant economic activity, encouraged by international loans, land grants, and government policies aimed at producing beef for export, especially to the United States. At the same time, the rise of commercial agriculture, bananas, sugar, pineapples, further accelerated land clearing. Forests that had once been dense and impenetrable were reduced to fields and pastures in a matter of years. By the early 1980s, deforestation in Costa Rica had reached alarming levels. Nearly 80% of the country's forests had been cut down. The nation was losing over 50,000 hectares of forest per year. Rivers dried, hillsides eroded, biodiversity declined, and a creeping sense of unease began to grow. Costa Rica, once lush and verdant, was bleeding green. But then, something remarkable happened. Instead of accepting deforestation as the cost of development, Costa Rica reversed course. Not slowly, not symbolically, but boldly. It became the first tropical nation in the world to not just slow deforestation, but to actually reverse it. The turnaround, a green awakening. This transformation didn't happen overnight. It was a result of visionary leadership, grassroots activism, scientific insight, and international cooperation, all converging around a single powerful idea. Nature was not a barrier to progress. It was the foundation of it. In the 1970s and 1980s, a new generation of environmental thinkers began to gain influence. Many were Costa Rican scientists, students, and policymakers who had studied abroad and returned with ideas about ecology, conservation biology, and sustainable development. One of the most influential voices was Mario Boza, a young biologist who co-authored proposals for the creation of protected areas and national parks. Along with others, he helped lay the groundwork for what would become Costa Rica's national park system, a network of sanctuaries that would eventually cover over 25% of the country's territory, one of the highest percentages in the world. The parks preserved cloud forests, coastal mangroves, volcanic ridges, rainforests, dry forests, and marine habitats. They became refuges for over 500,000 species, including 5% of the world's biodiversity, all packed into a country smaller than West Virginia. But protecting nature was only half the story. The other half was turning that nature into livelihoods. From chainsaws to camera lenses, the rise of ecotourism. Costa Rica's green revolution was not just an act of preservation. It was also an economic strategy, a radical reimagining of what prosperity could look like. Rather than cut down trees to sell lumber, Costa Rica would invite the world to walk among the trees and pay for the privilege. This was the birth of ecotourism, a concept that Costa Rica helped pioneer and elevate to a national economic pillar. The idea was simple but transformative. Protect nature, and nature will pay you back. By the 1990s and 2000s, Costa Rica was receiving millions of visitors per year, not for casinos or skyscrapers, but for zip lining through rainforest canopies, trekking through cloud forests, birdwatching, whale spotting, surfing, and soaking in volcanic hot springs. Ecolodges sprang up in Monteverde, Tortuguero, OSA Peninsula, and Arenal. Local communities found new sources of income. Guides, cooks, artisans, and conservationists thrived. And because the forests were preserved, their ecological functions, clean water, carbon storage, pollination, continued to benefit the nation as a whole. Ecotourism grew to represent over 8% of Costa Rica's GDP, and in many years, more than 15% of employment, a staggering achievement for a developing country. But even more importantly, it transformed the national mindset. Nature was no longer something distant, wild, or to be feared. It became part of what it meant to be Costa Rican, paying for ecosystems, a new economic model. In the 1990s, Costa Rica introduced another innovation, Pago por Servicios Ambientales, PSA, or Payment for Environmental Services. Under this program, landowners were paid by the government to preserve forests, protect watersheds, sequester carbon, and maintain biodiversity. Funding came from a combination of international aid, carbon credit markets, and a small tax on fossil fuels. It was a groundbreaking approach. For the first time, ecosystems were given economic value not for what could be extracted from them, but for what they gave back simply by existing. The PSA program turned conservation into a business model. Farmers who once cut trees for cattle could now earn money by leaving them standing. Over 1 million hectares of forest have been protected under this scheme. Costa Rica had created a green economy before the term had even entered global lexicon. Climate leadership on the world stage. By the early 2000s, Costa Rica had become a global beacon for sustainability. It was one of the first countries to commit to becoming carbon neutral, with a goal originally set for 2021 and now adjusted for mid-century, reflecting the complexities of transitioning energy and transportation systems. Its electricity grid became more than 98% renewable, powered by hydroelectric, geothermal, solar, and wind energy. While challenges remained in transportation and emissions from agriculture, the national narrative was clear. Costa Rica was not just preserving its forests, it was modeling a new path for the planet. Leaders like Cristiana Figueres, daughter of José Figueres Ferrer, would go on to lead international climate negotiations, including the landmark Paris Agreement in 2015, bringing Costa Rica's environmental diplomacy full circle. This small, unarmed republic was now punching far above its weight, not with soldiers, but with scientists, students, and trees. Challenges and realities. Despite its many achievements, Costa Rica's green revolution has not been without challenges. Monoculture farming, especially pineapples and bananas, continues to rely on heavy pesticide use and presents risks to water quality and biodiversity. Labor conditions in export agriculture remain a contentious issue. Tourism, while economically vital, can strain resources, infrastructure, and local ecosystems if not carefully managed. And climate change poses its own threats. Rising temperatures, shifting rainfall, and extreme weather events could reshape ecosystems and tourism patterns alike. But Costa Rica's strength lies in its institutional capacity, its civil society, and its deeply ingrained environmental ethos. It remains a country where public discourse includes environmental values, where schoolchildren plant trees and learn about ecosystems as part of their core curriculum. It is not perfect, but it is committed. A living example. Today, when visitors land in San Jose's Juan Santa Maria Airport, they are greeted not with monuments to military heroes, but with murals of Quetzal and sloths, posters about renewable energy, and welcoming smiles from a country that knows what it stands for. Costa Rica is not just a green republican policy. It is a green republic in spirit. Its forests are no longer just backdrops. They are characters in the national story. Its rivers are not just natural resources. They are lifelines, legacies, and living symbols of what a small country can accomplish when it dares to dream outside the norms of power. In the next chapter, we will explore how Costa Rica navigated the regional turmoil of the Cold War, remaining peaceful even as the surrounding nations burned, and forging a path of neutrality, mediation, and moral diplomacy that would define its role in the hemisphere.